I'm Lester Graham, and this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Physicians are saying the Trump travel ban could cause a doctor shortage.
So by implementing such a ban, we will kind of restrict workforce.
Well, there are about a study that shows inequality is getting worse in Detroit.
Decline is continuing. Growth in the central areas is continuing, but not fast enough to offset the declines in many of the neighborhoods.
Been fishing lately? Here's a chance to do it even if you don't have a license.
You can head out and fish any public water body throughout the state that you're interested in.
For free. We've got a Michigan band for you, Frontier Ruckus, and what's behind their music.
A lot of this record is about that, the idea of childhood innocence abruptly colliding with adult reality.
And we'll have another edition of our Artisans of Michigan. But first, stuff's happening in the world. Let's get a news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For people in Michigan, Sudan, Yemen, Syria, and the other four countries affected by President Trump's immigration ban probably seems world away. The Trump administration says it's going to rewrite the ban, and that could have a direct impact on the health care options for some in our state. An article for The Conversation outlines what's at stake, and joining me now are the two authors of that article. John Burkhart is lecturer at the University of Michigan and a physician with the Department of Emergency Medicine at U of M. Mashita Beer is assistant professor, Department of Emergency Medicine, and the director of the Acute Care Research Unit at the University of Michigan. The current immigration ban is temporarily suspended by the courts, but you write that the travel ban has already had a significant consequence. How?
Well, this is actually a pretty key time in the graduate medical education timeline. As people preparing to match into residency, which is where physicians do their training in hospitals, rank lists are coming out and program directors are making decisions about who they're going to invite into their training program. And so this uncertainty complicates that issue for international medical students, both from those seven countries, but I think the overall uncertainty about what the culture for international medical students is going to be in the future makes it both uncomfortable for the applicants as well as the programs trying to make a decision on who to invite.
The American Medical Association has written a letter to the Department of Homeland Security. It says the ban could affect people who are already underserved by healthcare professionals by limiting doctors from other countries. Explain how that happens.
So a lot of doctors who are immigrant physicians from other countries serve in rural communities and underserved communities, and also hospitals across the United States, be it in urban centers or safety net hospitals in both urban and rural rural areas, are staffed by physicians from other nations who train in the U.S. So by implementing such a ban, we will kind of restrict workforce, and the hospitals will have to struggle to staff appropriately, and we'll need to probably resort to hiring nurse practitioners and physician's assistants who will cost more and increase the expenditures for our healthcare system.
I want both of you to respond to this. Why have we had such a long-term doctor shortage? I was in a rural area where there was one gynecologist trying to serve three counties. Why is that a problem to begin with?
Well, it's really a multifactorial problem. It starts off with, in the kind of distant past, there was a projection that there would be a glut of physicians. And so there was not the kind of infrastructure put in to kind of rapidly expand our numbers. But now we have a highly graying population of both physicians and the American population in general. So we're going to have physicians who are retiring, and we're going to have increased needs for health care. Also, a big limit on how much physician population can grow is the residency numbers available for training, and that has been relatively static despite some increases in the number of medical schools. In general, training a physician is extraordinarily expensive both at the medical school level and at the graduate medical education level, and so rapidly expanding while maintaining kind of the same standards is very challenging, and so it's not an immediately responsive workforce.
You two wrote that the demand for physicians is so high that there's no way there are enough U.S. medical school graduates to meet that need. Does this mean there will be a shortage of an increased shortage of doctors if this immigration ban on these seven countries is upheld?
It certainly could, and particularly if they expand this ban and include other nations, then certainly we may face a situation where we not only don't have enough trainees to staff the hospitals appropriately, that we will have a shortage in primary care down the line long term.
Well, that's a good point, because we're talking about just seven countries. Put aside the principle of the thing for a moment. But are there really that many physicians or students from those seven countries that it'll make have a real impact on healthcare?
I think it really depends on where you're talking about, because each of these residency programs are designed for a certain number of physicians in training to be staffing the hospitals to provide care in their clinics and in the on their wards. And a 10% or 15% reduction in some of those programs could be catastrophic in that specific area. So even this small number of decreased physicians coming from other countries will have significant impact in those areas. I also think in the broader sense, it changes what the message we're putting out to international medical graduates about the welcomingness of coming here to train and whether they're going to be able to find a role here long term. Whether that just affects those seven countries or many other countries, we are in desperate need for these highly trained physicians to come and supplement our workforce. And if they don't feel like this is going to be a place that they can be comfortable or successful, that could have very long-term effects.
But President Trump says he's just trying to keep us safe. So that small adjustment to keep America safe, isn't that something we should consider?
Well, you know, this is actually very personal for me, being an Iranian Jewish physician immigrant. You know, I came here in 1991 at the age of 18, and I have had the privilege to serve multiple communities across the U.S., serve many patients, saved lives. And I feel like, aside from the numbers and the absolute numbers or percentages of physicians that it may affect or may not affect down the line, the fact that we need a diverse workforce to serve a nation of immigrants, I think is really important.
How will healthcare industry respond if this ban clears the courts?
I think that's a really good question. I don't know that we have an immediate answer. Some proposals, as Mishita has brought up, would be ideas of supplementing our physician workforce with mid-level providers, but that actually is more likely to increase costs, which is something that is a big concern. I think ultimately we're going to be in a position where we're going to have to rethink how we recruit and how we train physicians. My belief is that we need to tie our medical education system more strongly to the workforce development needs of the country. But as Dr. Beer brought up earlier, there's a lot of good evidence that diversity has important patient care outcomes regarding who gets care and the quality of that care. And by closing off a voice from outside the country, we hurt ourselves and hurt our patients, which is really what as physicians we're most dedicated to trying to prevent.
You noted in your article that not all segments of society will feel the impact the same way. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. A lot of immigrant physicians who train in the United States serve in underserved communities and rural areas and urban centers. And those are the places where we already have shortage of physicians in many instances, and a decrease in the workforce by virtue of having, you know, physicians who are from foreign nations serving those communities undoubtedly will affect those population more than others.
Okay, if you feel strongly like this, and we heard that the AMA sent a note to the Homeland Security, what do you think doctors should do about it right now?
Well, I think that's a challenging position because I think physicians are often apolitical, and I think it's time that we start advocating for our patients in a more broader sense. We advocate for our patients when we take care of them. We care deeply about providing that care, but I think we need to decide that these system issues have just as an important role in how our patients do. And we have to advocate for them by reaching out to our congressmen, reaching out to our senators, making our voices heard, and bringing the data and the facts regarding how this will impact our most at-risk populations. The patients that are going to require care that others won't provide is part of our professional responsibility. And I think internalizing that is how we make that change.
Dr. Abir, I'm going to give you the last word on this situation of the immigrant ban over the seven countries and the impact on the healthcare industry.
Well, there's really two sides to this. One is the immediate impact and one is the long-term impact. So in the months to come, given the fact that residency programs will need to select individuals for residency spots, it may result in shortages in resident physicians and trainees in hospitals, which will affect patient care. And number two, in the long term, if we are not welcoming these individuals from foreign countries into our residency programs, given the fact that many go into primary care and serve underserved areas, we may see an effect on primary care and the health of communities across the U.S.
Mishita Abir and John Burkhart, both with the University of Michigan and the authors of the article, how a travel ban could worsen doctor shortages in U.S. hospitals and threaten primary care. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks
Thank you for having us.
This weekend is a free fishing weekend in Michigan. Elise Walter is a spokesperson for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Why do you hold these free fishing days?
We hold these free fishing weekends as an opportunity to shine a spotlight on Michigan's phenomenal fisheries. We host a weekend both in the summer and the winter, and the idea is to encourage both residents and non-residents to get outdoors and get out on the water, have some fun, and not have to worry about purchasing a license or having a license on their person while they're out.
So out-of-state people, too, they're included in this free fishing weekend.
Of course. And what's nice about this coming weekend is since it's a holiday weekend, there's the potential for more travel from folks visiting us from surrounding states. And the idea is that this is a wonderful opportunity that they can take advantage of while they may be paying us a visit.
I saw there are events all around the state. Is free fishing limited to those events, or can you fish any stream or lake?
No, you can fish in whatever capacity you choose. Whether you're a new angler or someone who's very inexperienced, you could potentially attend one of these formal free fishing weekend events that are traditionally hosted by local sportsmen groups or state park and recreation areas. And what they'll do is often they'll teach you how to fish, and they'll show you how the equipment you'll need, and they even provide bait and instruction and things of that nature. Or you can head out on your own, whether you're avid or not, or you want to go with friends or family or by yourself. You can head out and fish any public water body throughout the state that you're interested in.
How far north do we have to actually have ice fishing?
Well, our weekly fishing report that comes out every Thursday this week indicated that even parts of the UP don't have fishable ice right now. So I would say that's very up in the air at this moment in terms of how fluctuating our temperatures have been throughout the state. So if I had to guess, I'd say pretty north. But you can still fish from shore this weekend. If you don't have fishable ice in your area, you can go to shore. You can go to a pier. You could even get your boat out if you are so inclined. There's plenty of opportunity to fish 365 days of the year. Regardless if there's ice or not, there's still probably going to be plenty of activity to be had.
That's Elise Walter with the Michigan DNR talking about the free fishing weekend this weekend. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, after a four-year hiatus, Michigan band Frontier Ruckus has a new album. We'll hear some of their new tunes and find out what took so long to put it out. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The city of Flint is considering a new city charter. It could change how city government operates, taxes, and more. It's already been reported by my colleague Steve Carmody that it could stiffen ethics rules and change other rules to make the city hall more transparent. The Flint Charter Review Commission is proposing the changes. Cleora McGee chairs the commission, and she joins us now. Ms. McGee, why is a rewrite of the city charter needed?
Well, the last time it was rewritten was in 1974. As you know, there have been a lot of changes since that time, and there's some things that we wanted to do to make sure that we had a stronger government.
After emergency management of Flint, is this kind of a reset or rethinking of government structure?
Yes, it is. You know, our form of government will stay the same, however, but there's some ethical standards that we've set forth. We just want to make it more stronger, have more citizen input.
It was reported that you were considering changes in the structure of government for the city. What kind of discussions did you have, and why did you decide to stay with a strong mayor and city council structure?
We didn't want to be divisive. We didn't want to cause divisions within the city. There were differences among our commissioners because we debated the issue, but we did come to an agreement that it was better for the city.
So outline some of the major changes being considered.
Strong ethics and improved charter enforcement. Enforcement has been a problem with the charter. We think that we have added some provisions that will strengthen that.
Well, let me stop you. What kind of problems?
Well, ethics within city government, basically not enforcing the charter when it comes to dropping areas and so forth. As an example, the ombudsman. That's one of the things that people really wanted, ombudsman's office. It was dropped. Civil service was dropped. We just wanted to make the charter stronger. We wanted to give it enforcement powers, and we have done that through an ethics and accountability board that would be responsible for that ombudsman, who would have the power to provide the enforcement power for the city.
What kind of input are you getting from the citizens of Flint?
We've gotten good input from citizens. One of the things we have tried to do since we were elected is try to be very transparent. We've had a number of community meetings, our regular meetings, always open to the public. And we invite citizens to come in and give their comments. And so right now we have a very strong, aggressive movement to get the word out that the draft is ready and we want public comment on that draft.
Can you give me a few examples of the kind of comments you've already received?
Well, on the ethics board, people really support that. Another area is we are proposing that we change the election cycle to have the election of city council along with the governor's election, the gubernatorial election, at the same time and the mayoral election, so that there will be more voter turnout, as well as we will have those that are running for council run for council, those that are running for mayor run for mayor, and not both.
What lessons that you learned because of the Flint water crisis informed this change?
Had there been a stronger enforcement of the charter, especially the ombudsman piece, if that had been in place? Plus, one of the things we have added to state that anytime there is an appointee made, that appointee must have those criteria necessary to run whatever office that person's going to run. So they would know what they're doing to have the basic knowledge of that department and what it takes to run a department.
What I think I hear you saying is, if you would have had stronger guidelines, a stronger charter before, you might never have had to have an emergency manager and everything that happened after that. Is that correct?
In part. You know, of course, we've had other problems with finances and so forth because, as you know, we've gone through a cycle of losing almost half of our population. So we realized that was a major problem as well. Hindsight would tell us that, yes, that's a possibility, along with a number of other issues.
Flint citizens will have the opportunity to vote on the new charter. When is that vote going to happen, and when will you know the final language of it?
We have completed the draft. We have a comment period, which started February 6th and will end March 6th. On March 8th, the proposed charter will be delivered to the Attorney General's office in Lansing, and they have up to 3 months to review it. And our hope is that we will have it on the August ballot.
What happens if the voters reject the new charter?
We have the opportunity to resubmit. We were elected in May of 2015, and we have up to 3 years to complete the process. So that would give us another opportunity to go back and review it, revise, and resubmit.
So you might put it before the voters a couple of times before everybody's happy with what's happening.
Yes, but our hope and our goal is to get it before the voters one time. And that is why we're strongly encouraging citizens to take a look at the charter that we are proposing. They can go online and look at it at www.flintcitycharter.com, and they can give comments as well, and then they can also look at the changes that were made. Then we have a meeting coming up on February 25th at Bethel United Methodist Church on Ballinger Highway in Flint, and we're asking people to come out to that meeting because we're going to take 3 hours to go over it, review, take comments, and just get, you know, opinions from the public. But we want to be transparent. We want people to know what's in the charter before they go to the polls.
We've been speaking with Cleora McGee, the chair of the Flint Charter Review Commission, which is proposing the city's guiding document be replaced. Thanks very much for explaining this to us.
Thank you so much.
Enter the Kingdom is the fifth LP from Michigan's own Frontier Ruckus. Rolling Stone calls it a serious and thought-provoking record. As part of our Songs from Studio East series, Stateside's Mercedes Mejia has this look at how the band continues to evolve musically while still holding on to their roots.
It took 4 years for Frontier Ruckus to come out with their newest album, Enter the Kingdom. Matthew Milia is lead vocalist and guitarist.
Enter the Kingdom kind of refers to the kingdom being my childhood home. The cover of the record is the window into my childhood bedroom, which is kind of the portal I'm referring to, the entrance into that world of memory. And this idea of a more innocent time in my life.
Summer's begun, the drummers are hungry, the sound of the gun on liver noise stung me. I wake in the afternoon, napping in your cocoon, hum.
staying true to his songwriting, Milia writes about the people and places closest to him. Memories of growing up in Metro Detroit, themes around family and financial struggles. Ideas Milia says American families can relate to.
Our sacred neighborhoods now only nominally exist. Your dad's looking for work on Craigslist.
The catalyst for this record, lyrically, was my dad losing his job and the impending possibility of us having to sell that childhood kingdom of memory, this place where I'd lived for pretty much all of my life. Luckily, it didn't end up happening. But, I mean, people lose their homes every day. It's even in, like, a suburban climate where there's this illusion of prosperity and the American dream happening, more and more people have been living beyond their means. And a lot of this record is about that idea of childhood innocence abruptly colliding with adult reality.
And Milia says he tries to lighten up those heavy emotional lyrics with catchy pop beats and that folk Americana Frontier Ruckus is known for.
Better someday when the TV letters of the station that I used to watch rearrange and spell my heaven, maybe channels 4 and 7 broadcast the entire life I botched. Everything will awaken, and if I am not mistaken,
something more that brings this new album from Frontier Ruckus back to its roots, the return of vocalist Anna Birch. She left the band before album number 4 came out, and she remembers just needing a break from the craziness of touring.
So I think that when I stepped away, I was, you know, at the tender age of 21, I believe, and had just graduated college, and we pretty immediately signed a record deal and got a booking agent, and we went from being like a college band to a band that was, you know, touring to a Google calendar that was filling up, and there was no real like light at the end of the tunnel in terms of coming home. So yeah, that was hard to do, and I think I was young enough that I figured there were probably other things out there besides just sitting in a van with 5 dudes.
And Milia remembers there was just something missing from the band.
We were missing your harmony. I mean, we had a great little period there when Anna was off doing her thing, where we made a record called Eternity of Dimming, and we toured a lot. But it was good to get back to that harmony that kind of was such a major component of our early identity.
Home watching my dad watch the NFL alone. Wish I still had that eternal telephone. I'd call you.
Yeah, I mean, I think Eternity of Dimming is a really important album to a lot of the fans, but it's also very difficult and long.
Right.
And yeah, I think, I don't know if they could have made that album with me still in the band.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a good thing that they got to take that detour. And yeah, I think my rejoining definitely brought Matt more into the mindset of singing duet style again, which definitely, you know, lent itself to more pop and concise songwriting, I think.
I want living love and mental access denser than the Motel Continental breakfast cereal dispenser. Want those eyes you made at me, those bedside globes, those orbs.
And the changes don't stop there. Frontier Ruckus recorded album number 5 in Tennessee, and it's the first time they added a string section.
Yeah, this is the first record we've done outside of Michigan, which was a necessary challenge we imposed upon ourselves. We did it with Ken Coomer in Nashville. Ken was the original drummer for Wilco, and he was the final drummer for Uncle Tupelo, so he's a major part of the Americana pedigree. So it was our first time working with a producer and with a string section. Zach made some beautifully sweeping string arrangements for the record. Yeah, so we were trying to make a slightly more polished product. I don't know, that, for lack of a better term.
I mean, yeah, I think we definitely wanted this record to be a little more polished and also ambitious. I mean, adding the string section and just kind of the way we recorded it, traveling to Nashville and posting up for a couple weeks, and we really had to have our stuff together. So we actually like demoed, and yeah, we were very prepared.
Ambitious and young, and just like most of us, they're still trying to figure out how to balance life with career. Milia writes about both in the song "Our Flowers Are Still Burning."
That was a song I kind of wrote as a kind of way of telling myself things are going to be okay. Our flowers burning, representing our fire still being lit, like a purpose to pursue. And I thought I was talking about my family and my childhood and all these sort of personal things when I wrote it. But also there was this dual meaning that I realized later. I was talking about the band and the hardships of just sustaining a band for 5 albums and, you know, not making millions of dollars and facing those realities. And I was saying, if we still have these creative flowers, it's still something to keep going after. When the party is through and the people you knew have all dissolved to day jobs that they're spurning, if I fail in the end just to find turning. Frontier Ruckus kicks off their 2017 Enter the Kingdom tour tonight with a show at the Old Dog Tavern in Kalamazoo. After hitting several spots here in the U.S., they head to Europe for a month-long tour. For Stateside, I'm Mercedes Mejia.
You can check out a live performance of Frontier Ruckus here at Michigan Radio. Just search for Songs from Studio East on our website. Well, we're back with another visit to one of the artisans of Michigan. This time we're in Monroe visiting Michigan Musical Instrument Service. Kevin Powers has been repairing instruments there since 1987.
I do most of the work for the Detroit Symphony, all the brass players, the Toledo Symphony, some of the guys from Cleveland. Those would be my occasional clients. My everyday ones are the school kids that come in with a dent in their trumpet, so That's who my normal customers are.
And those kids have an interesting way of damaging their instruments.
Usual thing of slip in the parking lot and fall on their horn, or, you know, they back over their tuba. Or I get a lot of work like that.
After college, where he got his initial training, Powers got a job at a high-end trumpet maker, Schilke Music Products in Chicago. That's where he got to make some trumpets for some names you might recognize.
Oh, right, yes. I built one for Dizzy Gillespie, one for John Faddis, and Wynton Marsalis. That's pretty cool. It's very cool. I was lucky that way.
Over the years, he's learned to fix just about anything, and he says he enjoys the challenge of all of them.
To me, if it's a bassoon or a oboe or a flute or a saxophone, clarinet, trumpet, trombone, whatever, I don't really prefer one or the other. For me, fortunately, I've become well-known for fixing brass musical instruments, particularly tubas and trumpets, but I don't really care which one it is.
Kevin Powers was once a professional musician, so he can play all the orchestral instruments for about 2.5 octaves, which comes in handy when he needs to test them after he fixes them. With the equipment in his shop, he can manufacture replacement parts or build new horns from scratch. But repairing them can be just pounding the big dents out of a horn.
You can start out the dents just by tapping them.
Then using special tools to basically rub the wrinkles and smaller dents out.
You're literally just pressing the wrinkles out.
Pretty much, just pushing them along.
He says, though, fewer guys like him can stay in the business.
With the way the schools have been going, closing, and the state and the federal government drawing money back for the endowment for the arts, school closings and consolidation on schools have ruined music programs. There really isn't enough work for more than a few guys in any major city to put the food on the table. So it's tough.
Add to that, with cheaper horns being imported, it's sometimes less expensive to buy a brand new trumpet than to have one repaired. I asked him if he spends a lot of time alone in his shop, and he says, not really. there's always somebody dropping by, and he's okay with that.
You know, they want to come in and see what's going on and watch me swing a hammer when I'm fixing a horn or building a new one. I get a lot of joy out of that, the fact that people want to come by and you know, chit-chat about music and, you know, while I'm working, you know. So they'll come and watch me do it. I don't mind. Take a look over my shoulder.
That's Kevin Powers at Michigan Musical Instrument Service in Monroe, another of our artisans of Michigan. In 2 weeks from now, we'll talk to a guy who has loved printing presses since he was a boy.
And there was a printing press in the garage. And it had a great big flywheel. And it actually was exactly the printing press on the other side of the shop. And I just loved the machine.
And now he's combining the love of the printing press with his love of words as a professor of literature. That's in 2 weeks here on Stateside. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, we'll hear about a study that shows inequality is getting worse in Detroit. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder admonished Republicans for rushing legislation to eventually eliminate the state income tax. He wrote, "I hope the House will be more deliberate before taking a full vote." Joining me now are Vicki Barnett, the former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican legislative leader. Vicki, there was something like 90 minutes of testimony in a hearing for this income tax repeal bill. What more do legislators need than that?
Well, usually you want to hear from some experts in management and budget, and you want to make sure that you're on the right track and that you fully understand the ramifications of the tax breaks that are already baked into the system that are going to be edging in online as the next few years go by. So it's been a problem for a long time that committees rush through legislation and then the logic is, well, we'll just fix it on the floor. And there's no time to fix anything on the floor, not adequately. So I think everybody wants to get their hands on saying we're going to give money back to the people without realizing that there's no Keebler elves that come out of the trees at night and fix the roads and the broken infrastructure and educate our kids and make sure that our cattle have bovine TB injections. So I don't know.
Ken, House Speaker Tom Leonard says about the legislation, it's not a difficult bill to understand. What does the bill say about the consequences of eliminating the income tax?
Well, that's the governor's point. The bill is silent about the consequences. In the first year, it's $1 billion in lost revenue, and that means $1 billion in spending cuts somewhere, which House Republicans up to this point have been silent about. And that's really the issue. I mean, the governor, actually, his language was kind of polite, I thought. What it really means, it's translated into, you know, show me the spending cuts. And that's the responsible way to do it.
Ken, we talked about the rainy day fund and the governor wants to increase it. I saw a senator post on Facebook that he thought $500 million was plenty for the rainy day fund. What do you think of that?
No, it's not. That's actually a silly comment. The rainy day fund was over $1 billion when the recession hit, which put more demands on state spending. That over $1 billion, about $1.5 billion, was gone in about 18 months. So the notion that a savings account at the state level that has a budget of $55 billion, the notion that $500 million is adequate is just silly.
Vicki, you had another observation about this income tax elimination bill?
Yes. In 2011, when we overhauled the entire Michigan business tax and created this new tax, there was a hole created in that budget of about $1.8 billion. And for the next few years, the legislature had to scramble to come up with money to plug that hole. As a result, we finally have figured out how to do that, and now they want to go cut taxes again. And I don't understand what this magic number of 3.9% seems to be that's stuck in their brains.
Let's move on to another topic. Kalamazoo, Saginaw, and Detroit schools are fighting the possible closings of 38 schools across the state. Even the State Board of Education thinks it's a bad idea. Governor Snyder's school reform office says these schools are at risk of closing because they're poor-performing schools. Vicki, a lot of people are perturbed by this. How do you think the Snyder administration has handled this situation?
Extremely poorly. First of all, They moved the state reform officer out of the Department of Education and put it in with the technology management and budget team, so it's now housed in the governor's house. The problem there is that people who work for the school reform office and did some of these tours of the schools had no idea what the impact of closing that school would be on transportation. Sometimes they said, if there's a school within 30 miles, it's okay. Well, a kid can't walk 30 miles to school every day. There was no understanding in Kalamazoo of how it would affect kids with the Kalamazoo Promise, because some of the people who walk through the schools did not know what the Kalamazoo Promise is. This is a hasty decision. It's been a problem since we passed this school reform law back in about 2010. And closing schools is not necessarily the answer to improving low-performing schools. They may need more money, more technical assistance, and all of that is provided by the Department of Education.
Ken, it's certainly a disservice to the kids if they're not getting an adequate education, but how will simply closing the school help them?
Well, I think it's a good thing, actually, to identify these chronically poor performing schools, kind of the worst of the worst. I think that's actually a good thing. But that kind of severe academic situation, I think, is indicative of many, many things, both in the community and probably at home. And that entire situation is going to have to get addressed to, I think, turn around the academic situation.
What are you saying? We're going to have to, what, eliminate poverty, which is a big impact, or pumping more money into the schools because you've got a lot of kids who are behind because they're suffering through poverty and other issues?
I think poverty is part of it. I think, you know, family dysfunction is part of it. But there are things the state can do to address that. You know, if you have a single mother at home with young children, you know, you can provide good, high quality daycare so that person can get into the workforce. There are some it's not hopeless. There are things that can be done. But my point is, it's not just sort of the school that needs to be focused on.
Finally, let's talk about President Donald Trump's news conference yesterday. Vicki, thoughts on what the president had to say?
First of all, it was like watching a train wreck. You didn't want to watch it, but you couldn't take your eyes away. It was a careening nightmare of accusations and attacks on the media and his former opponent. All week long, when we've watched the president, and even last week when he was meeting with foreign leaders and they were doing press conferences, he can't not mention that he got more electoral college votes than anyone expected him to get. Let's move on and address the problems of the country and stop blaming the Democrats and his former opponent for the problems in getting his nominees pushed through. The Republicans are in control of the House and the Senate. It is not a problem for his party. Obviously, the names he's coming up with are a problem. And the things that he's trying to do, he's not clearing with the rest of the Democrats trying to form a logical team of governance. This is quite frightening.
Ken, yesterday during the news conference, President Trump called the media, varying on depending on who it was, either dishonest or very dishonest. That seemed to be the entire spectrum. And then last night, the White House sent out an email and a questionnaire to his supporters, which basically asked them to judge whether the news media are fair to him. What purpose does that serve?
Well, part of the sort of narrative coming out of this and the entire 4 or 5 weeks of the Trump presidency is kind of Trump versus the media or media versus Trump. We have to remember that he got elected president. I mean, my point is a lot of people voted for Trump. And I think part of it is because for many years, the national media has kind of seen themselves as the arbiters of what is true and not true. And for a lot of people in this country, you know, what is reported and how it's been reported over the years doesn't really reflect their values or who they think they are. He got elected president, I think, in part because of that attitude, really, and opinion of the national media. So, and I think that's part of it here.
Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thank you for talking with us about this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
For the last couple of years, conventional wisdom is suggesting Detroit is recovering. Every new restaurant, boutique store, retail chain that's setting up shop in Detroit's central business districts is offered as proof. There's a major flaw in that assessment. The people in the neighborhoods are not sharing in that new prosperity. A recent article in The Conversation argues, if anything, the plight of Detroit's longtime residents is actually getting worse. Gary Sands is a professor emeritus at the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at Wayne State University, and he's co-author of that article. Your research reached two major conclusions. First, Detroit is still in decline. And second, the recovery that's getting so much attention is resulting in increasing inequality. Let's look at the first one. So what evidence do you have that Detroit is still declining?
Well, there's a number of things. One, probably the most critical one, is that the number of jobs in the neighborhoods, both in terms of the people who live in the neighborhoods and the jobs that are physically located in the neighborhood, are both declining. Detroit has one of the lowest employment participation rates of any city in the country. I think Flint and Gary, Indiana are a little worse off, but not by much. And so you've got a huge jobs deficit in the neighborhoods. And when you bring jobs into Midtown or downtown, whether it be Quicken Loans or Microsoft or whoever, it doesn't do as much good for the people who are in the neighborhoods. And even if some suburban millennials move into neighborhoods in Detroit, Midtown, Corktown, it doesn't really do anything for the roughly 600,000 people who are not on board with the rising tide in downtown Midtown.
I want to get to that point a little further, but I want to look at that second major conclusion. You say the revival of the central business districts is increasing inequality. How's that?
Well, if you look at data on payrolls and income from employment for Detroit, it's going up in downtown Midtown in zip codes 48201 and 48226. But in every other area of the city, the total payrolls are going down. The average wage rate in downtown Midtown is perhaps four or five times what it is in the neighborhoods. And that's not sustainable.
As you mentioned, most of the jobs being created in downtown are being filled by suburbanites. They're basically high-tech jobs. But the number of jobs held by residents dropped, as you mentioned. Why is this happening? Why are we losing jobs in the outer part of Detroit, outside of the business district?
Well, part of it is a kind of a vicious cycle of decline. I mean, you've got folks who are not making much money, who are dependent on part-time work or public assistance of some sort. Those folks cannot afford to shop in neighborhood grocery stores or other kinds of retail facilities. So those disappear. Those jobs disappear as well. You've got limited skill sets, poorly educated, poorly in terms of educational attainment, how many years they've been in school.
Right. The literacy rate is low in Detroit.
Right.
We know that.
And the quality of the education they've received is not as good as it should be. So that's why their folks are at a disadvantage in terms of getting the jobs that are there. You're losing jobs because there's no market to support them in the neighborhoods.
One of the suggestions that you make and others have made is better work skills training for Detroit residents. Mayor Mike Duggan has announced that Michigan's largest skilled trades union is committing to tripling the number of Detroit residents in its ranks to expand career opportunities. What did you think of that agreement with the city?
I think it's a very positive step, and I think that what concerned me is the speed at which stuff is happening. And decline is continuing, growth in the central area is continuing, but not fast enough to offset the declines in many of the neighborhoods. So it's great. City is doing lots of good things in the neighborhoods, just not enough to change the pattern.
You suggested Detroit residents need better transportation to get to a job, increased access to capital to foster entrepreneurship, and significant public education improvements, as you just mentioned there. How did Detroit and the state of Michigan make all of that happen? That's costly.
It is, and it also is very difficult in the sense that a lot of it doesn't have a payoff within 6 months, a year, within the electoral cycle.
Yeah, you're talking decades here.
Yeah. Right? And, I mean, it's taken six decades to decline to the point where we are today. It's not going to be fixed in the next 3 years.
So where's the money come from?
According to the estimates I've done, Detroit is short close to 100,000 jobs. There should be 100,000 more Detroiters in employment than there are currently. If those people all worked at Walmart wage jobs, $10 an hour, that's $2 billion a year pumped into the Detroit economy. That's a start.
There's been a fair amount of criticism about tax incentives and tax breaks for developing sports stadiums and other big projects. Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans wants even more breaks in order to further develop downtown projects. Why do you believe these need to be reevaluated?
Well, it's basic economics, I think, is that if you're trying to get people to use more of something, you subsidize it. You make it cheaper. I mean, if you've got labor and capital to go into a process, if you subsidize capital, people will use more and less labor. If you want to get more people in work, you subsidize labor and not the capital. So every time you invest in a building, you're making it, or a machine in Public Act 198, industrial tax abatements, you make that more attractive. People will use more of that and consequently less labor. And that's what I think it needs to be evaluated.
The other thing that you bring up is it also means a reduction in tax revenue for all the entities, for like TIF districts, enterprise zones, things like that.
Yeah. Taxes are being either not paid or diverted to special projects, special activities, and not benefiting the community at large. And some pump priming may be a good thing, but I think it's shifted from being the exception to the rule.
But that's because cities like Detroit and states like Michigan have to compete with other states and other cities for some of these developments.
Ideally, what you would like to see is that the first project is heavily subsidized and the second project is a little less subsidized and moving towards a more balanced market kind of a result. I don't see that happening. The subsidies are just as generous today as they were in 1965 when I started this.
You know, underlying all of this is the fact that Detroit is two very different cities. One white and privileged, the other black and deprived. What will that mean for the future of Detroit?
I wish I knew. It scares me. It scares me a lot because I don't see it changing. And I think that the huge disparities in Detroit are what sets Detroit apart from other cities nationally. If you look at New Orleans, you have a significant white middle class as well as a fairly large black, African-American, lower income component of the population. In Detroit, it's almost everyone is in the lower income, whether they're white, black, Hispanic.
The middle class made an exodus to the suburbs.
Yeah. And the middle class African-Americans are moving just as fast as the whites.
Right.
So if nobody's going to stay around to try and make things work, I don't know what's going to happen.
Gary Sands is a professor emeritus in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at Wayne State University. He's co-author of the article, Detroit's Recovery, The Glass is Half Full at Most. You can find it at theconversation.com. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock, who fixed my computer today, so he's okay today. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.